and Beatles. Now, what does that mean? Again, I have no idea. So, I mean, I work on this for a decade, and this is kind of the best I can do. That it happens. And this is the problem with studying global change and insect conservation, is we're really at the stage right now of just trying to figure out even what's happening, let alone what it means. So one possibility of what this means, though, is that there's an increase in predators under elevated CO2, and maybe that's what's driving down the numbers of prey under elevated CO2. So, you know, that's speculation at this point, but at least it's food for thought. Now let's come back to temperature. Temperature certainly is an important aspect of global change. This is a picture just showing you for the northeastern United States, the temperatures are in fact increasing, and they're increasing kind of more than the global average. Kind of the further north you go, the hotter things are getting. So, you know, the kind of the, what color is that? The orangish and the reddish circles are 3 to 4 degree Celsius increases, or 4 to 5 degrees Celsius increases in wintertime temperatures in the northeastern United States. So there's no question that this is going to do something to insects. And we're already seeing this starting. These are data, and you can get these data from the Northeast Climate Impacts website. But this is for corn earworm. Corn earworm does not overwinter in the northeastern United States. It overwinters further south, and it kind of, and the moths fly in the springtime. And you can see in 1995, the moths were appearing sometime around August 1st. And in 2003, the moths were appearing sometime in June. And so again, is climate change the only cause for this? How can you tell? We don't have 20 Earths and 10 of them with people on them and 10 of them without people on them. But it's very suggestive that at least we're seeing changes in the time that the insects, these insects are flying northwards. Now, despite the fact that what the kind of the first slide I showed you of insects are going to take over the world because it's going to get hot and there's going to be what there was one about the invasion of ants and there's insects are going to explode, we have this very strange consequence in the Northeast that things are getting hotter and colder at exactly the same time. Now, what does that mean? So it's getting hotter in the northeastern United States. I showed you the slide that says it's 4 to 5 degrees hotter over much of New York and New England. And this is bringing about significantly decreased snow. So for example, the big brown dots are areas where there's 25 days less of snow cover in the wintertime. So a friend of mine, David Wolfe at Cornell, did an experiment where he removed snow from areas in the middle of winter. On this graph across the top is date, and down the side is the depth of soil frost. The first line up there, I guess I'm supposed to point with this thing. This line here is just the normal with snow, and this line here is the depth of soil frost when you take the snow away. So and we're seeing this this is just soil, but we're seeing this in plants. There's significantly more cold injury in, for example, the wine industry, the grape growing industry in New York, even though it's hotter. And with the case of plants, the reason for this is the plants aren't cold hardening properly because fall is going so far into the winter, and then it gets cold all of a sudden. So even though it's warmer, the plants are getting more cold injury. And even though it's warmer, soil depths are freezing deeper, 35 centimeters as opposed to 5. So the insects that are actually marginally overwintering in the northeastern United States are probably going to be affected by this. Now again, there's no study at all on whether or not this is affecting insects or not. This is different. But again, this is to, you know, kind of throw some data out at you to start thinking about the fact that global change is complicated. It's not just things getting hotter. It's things getting hotter and colder simultaneously. So this is a projection of what winter in the Northeast might look like. So the red line is kind of the winter in the Northeast that we know now. The white areas are the areas which might have significant snowfall by 2070 to 2100, say, which is the Maine and the Adirondack Mountains in New York State. So much of the Northeast is projected not to really have much snow anymore, which is going to increase these freezing depths at least for the next several decades, if not on into the next century. So what can we expect? Well, I've already showed you that just elevated CO2 in the atmosphere changes feeding and performance, in our particular case in Japanese beetles. It changes community composition in the forest. There's other studies that have shown that that elevated CO2 can change host plant preference in organisms, tree herbivore parasitoid interactions, so higher trophic level interactions, and there's altered genotypic and phenotypic frequencies also seen just from the CO2 part of the global change. As climate's changing, both temperature as well as snow and water, we are expecting changes in insect overwintering, phenology in terms of the time that the insects are coming out in the spring, and how this might be in phase or out of phase with plant flowering. Migrations and distributions. So I just want to acknowledge lots of people were involved in the various bits of data that I showed in this talk. And that slide just remind me, don't go more. So with that, I'll take any questions.
We've got time to, I want to try to get us on to the schedule in the conference proceedings, just so that people coming in can, know that when they get here, we're on target. So if there are questions, let's take our time and do it, and then give Karen some extra time to do that.
In the soybean study, we looked at the effect of elevated CO2 on everything. So we just basically trapped everything we possibly could. The year that I show the data for, there was no effect on soybean aphid. But in subsequent years, there actually was an effect on soybean aphid. So it's year by year. It depends. This particular year that I showed the data for was kind of the year of the Japanese beetle. We were all geared up to really go after them again the next year, and there weren't as many. And then the year after that, there were basically none. So they'll be back again, and we'll be ready for them next time. But now there's things going on with the aphids.
Could you briefly touch on asynchrony and flowering with pollinators? Are you familiar with any of that global warming work?
Jason, can you repeat
the question? Right. So the question is, can I just touch on this idea of asynchrony and flowering? Basically, plants, when they're coming out of dormancy, are primarily keying on day length. And insects, when they're coming out of dormancy, even though there certainly is photoperiod involved with it, they're often keying in on temperature more strongly than the plants are. And so, because the climate is changing rapidly, temperature is changing rapidly, and clearly day length is not changing rapidly, there's the potential, at least, for any animal, not just insects, any animal that's keying in on temperature to basically come out of hibernation at the wrong time. And this is starting to be seen in both vertebrates as well as invertebrates. There's evidence that this is happening with insects, and there's evidence that this is happening with birds, and there's evidence that this is happening with mammals, that there's this mismatch between the animals arriving and their food source. So either they're getting there too early or they're getting there too late. So the question is, are there data available which would tell us how much of a buffer forests would be on atmospheric carbon dioxide? Are you talking about kind of the carbon storage capacity of forests? So this is both tricky and controversial in terms of the amount of carbon that can be taken up in forests. there's no question that, you know, trees store carbon. The problem is that if you want to use trees as a carbon reservoir, you have to make sure that that tree, that wood stays wood kind of indefinitely. And so natural forests then they burn down or the trees die or whatever, and then you lose all of the carbon storage that you've lost. And the ecosystem studies of kind of old growth forests indicate that you lose one large tree and you've lost all of the carbon storage that you've done for years. At the same time, probably the best thing in terms of forests and carbon storage is this latest proposal. I think it comes from Papua New Guinea, which is that they should get the developing countries who have significant forest resources should get carbon credits for not cutting their forests down. And that's actually probably a very good idea. The problem is that when this was first proposed in the early days of the Kyoto negotiations, the United States essentially tried to pull a fast one. You know, we deforested the entire Northeast kind of before 1800, 1820, that kind of thing. Starting around 1840s, the Northeast started reforesting, and the United States negotiators attempted to get carbon credits for this reforestation that was going on anyway. And so because of that, basically, the rest of the world cried foul and took away the carbon credit for anything to do with forest, unless it was actual planting. Which gives developing countries a real problem, because if they could not cut down a forest, that's a huge amount of carbon that's just going to stay there locked as trees. So planting trees may or may not help. It depends on whether or not you can keep them from kind of burning down or dying for the next century or two. The reforestation that we have going on right now in the United States doesn't really count, because we did that 100 years ago. So the best thing is don't cut down any new forests. Thank you.
But citizen science can have many, many different uses. So I like to think of it as a tool for research, education, and community development. And it involves people who are not professional scientists in authentic scientific research. So what I'd like to do to just kind of start this is talk about what I consider four basic elements of any citizen science program, and different programs will differ in the amount they emphasize each of these, but I think they all contain them to some degree. So first of all, it involves citizens, or people who are not professional scientists. Now, the term citizen may be an unfortunate one. A lot of people argue about that because we might think that it has connotations of being connected with some particular country. We don't really mean that. We just mean the general public when we say citizen science. So that's a term that we're stuck with, and I think we just don't need to worry that some people think, well, if you're not a citizen of a particular country, can you really engage in it? That's not what we mean. Another important element that it involves professional scientists at some level, and this level can vary from project to project. So professional scientists can be involved in training, in designing the scientific protocols that the volunteers use, in analyzing and or publishing the data. So there are many different ways that scientists can be involved. And there is actually some argument that citizen science programs don't have to involve professional scientists, but most of them, at least at this point, still do. Another important component is that citizen science programs result in useful data that advance scientific understanding and in some cases can be applied to real-world problems. And the real-world problem connections are very important because people are more likely to be attracted to programs if there is some real-world application. They'll be less likely to be attracted if it only has basic science implications. The picture here is a man looking at a big die-off of monarch butterflies that occurred in 2002. I should say that I'm a monarch butterfly biologist, so that's why you see monarchs on every page here. But this die-off of monarchs in 2002 was an interesting application of the data that volunteers are collecting on monarch butterfly populations, because we could look at the long-term impacts of this die-off. So that was a real-world application of the data that our volunteers were collecting. Finally, and this is different from a lot of other research tools, is that most citizen science programs have some kind of a clearly defined educational component. And again, this varies a lot from one program to another. And in some ways, this is kind of an historical artifact. Most of us who have funding for our citizen science projects get that funding from the informal science education arm of the National Science Foundation. So we really have had to emphasize education, which I think has had a big impact on how citizen science has developed in this country. So what I'd like to do now with that background is just kind of use a project that I run along with many other people as a case study of how citizen science can help to create a research army for conservation. And the program that I run is called the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project. It'll be starting its 12th year next summer. And what our volunteers do is monitor the distribution and abundance of immature monarchs during their, as they're moving out of Mexico into the United States in the spring, in the spring and the summer, and then as they're breeding. So our volunteers are not looking at the entire annual cycle of monarch butterflies. Instead, they're looking at them during their breeding in the spring, summer, and sometimes in the fall. This, like many citizen science projects, has really been able to grow with the advent of a lot of access to the web of citizens throughout the country. So all of our directions for participation, data sheets are online. People enter their data online, and the data are displayed online, so they're visible without very much work on the part of the project organizers. And this is something that has really helped projects grow over the last several years, is access to the web for a lot of people. So what people do who are involved with our project, our volunteers find out about the project, decide that they want to volunteer, and they choose a site. Some citizen science projects have clearly defined sites for people to use, but our volunteers choose any site that they want. All that is required is that they have some milkweed available. The sites can be gardens, parks, roadsides, prairies, anything that has any milkweed growing. They describe the site, locating it so that we can look at the effects of different locations, sizes of site, kind of site, and we also have them identify the milkweed species, the host plant of monarchs that are present in the site, and the density of milkweed growing in that site. And on a weekly basis, and this separates our program from a lot of other ones because it does take a lot of time, every week the volunteers go out and estimate monarch densities on a per plant basis. So they look at lots and lots of milkweed plants and count the number of monarch eggs and larvae that they see. They quantify the quality of the milkweed, looking at herbivory and flowering status and height of the milkweed. I'll talk a little bit about estimating parasitism rates. And some of our volunteers track weather conditions, but that's optional, and it's becoming less important as there's so many weather data available online. This just gives you an idea of where our volunteers are located. You can see that we really emphasize the eastern migratory population of monarch butterflies, but we do have a few volunteers in California that represent the western population. I'm not going to use that arrow anymore. So we have a pretty good representation from the eastern migratory population. And the data, like I said, are immediately able for people can visualize the data right after they're entered. And the kind of the core of the project allows people to look at temporal variation in monarch distribution or monarch abundance over the course of a summer. And the data can be compiled for an entire state or for a single site. So here you see data in North Carolina in 2003. You can see how monarchs move into the area. There's a dearth of monarchs during the summer, and then they move back in the fall. The bars represent the density of the stages of monarchs, so the black part of the bar is the density of eggs on a per plant basis, and the different colors represent the different larval instars. So So you can really get a good picture with the data that have been entered on how when monarchs are present and how their abundance changes over the course of the year. So this is a southern state, and we can contrast that with a northern state, Minnesota, where we would wear chacos if it's 50 degrees. You can see the weeks across the bottom of the graph and the density, so you have a more consistent availability of monarchs, consistent presence of monarchs throughout the course of the summer. And there are lots of things that we've done with these data. This just shows you one thing we've looked at, comparing the height of that second peak of monarch population, so the peak that actually will be the generation that migrates to Mexico. We look at the per plant abundance of eggs. So this shows you how that's varied over 11 years of the project. You can see there's a lot of annual variation in numbers, and obviously what we're doing now is trying to correlate that variation to different things that are going on in the environment. There are many other ways that we're using these data. We're looking at importance of predators and parasites, a lot of conservation implications, land use changes, pesticides, different environmental perturbations. We've used the data to look at how monarchs might respond to climate change using ecological niche models. And I'm not going to tell you about all these, but I just wanted to share some of the neat things that the volunteers are finding about predators and parasites. For one thing, they get very interested in the monarchs that they're, or in the larvae that they're monitoring, and take some great pictures. So here are some pictures that they've taken of predators. You can see a stink bug eating a monarch larva, ants, a little red velvet spider mite in the bottom picture, and that's probably not a predator in the top. Somebody just sent me that picture. Probably a better entomologist than me would know what that is, but it's kind of an interesting picture that one of the volunteers took. We've actually quantified parasitoids. There's an important monarch parasitoid, Lespizia archiepivora, a tachinid fly, that's always fatal. You can see the larva coming out of a monarch larva right there. They pupate, and then the adult fly develops. And a lot of our volunteers collect late instar monarchs and bring them in to see the rate of tachinid fly parasitism. And here you can see, this is actually from a paper that we published a couple years ago. Using data from the volunteers, we actually had some of our citizen scientist volunteers as co-authors on this paper. But you can see how the rates of parasitism vary from year to year. And I've just compiled data for this slide from upper Midwestern sites. But you can see we had a few years in the early 2000s with really high tachinid fly rates. The black parts of these bars are the proportion of larvae that our volunteers collected that were parasitized by tachinid flies. And the red just represents those that died from other causes, and the blue is ones that resulted in healthy adult monarch butterflies. So from a scientific perspective, this citizen science project, I think, represents a lot of other citizen science projects in that there are important scientific outcomes. And one of the things that we've learned is that a lot can be learned from basic distribution and abundance data. And this is the kind of, these are the kind of data that citizen scientists are really good at collecting, distribution and abundance data. The data can then be used to provide direction for experimental and theoretical research, and can also be used for conservation purposes to inform public policy and conservation efforts. But I think it's even more important to look at the outcomes for the volunteers. Because we are funded by the National Science Foundation, we had to do a lot of evaluation of the impacts of this project. And the most important reason that people gave for their participation, their donation, and lots and lots of hours in this project, is that their work could help promote monarch conservation. They were also really interested in just their work leading to increased understanding of monarch biology. So they really valued, they wanted their contributions to be valued, and they thought that their contributions were important to both conservation and basic understanding of monarchs. They also really like being involved in real scientific research. From a conservation perspective, in addition to just all these people getting involved with the project, we're producing data that can have very important applied value. We're also producing concerned, vocal, and very informed citizens. So our volunteers are very likely to talk to newspaper reporters, to go out and talk to schools, and really spread the word about insect conservation. So I kind of want to end with a little bit of an advertisement here, because I think entomology is a great place for to have citizen science used as a tool. And I kind of sat down when I was preparing this talk and thought about what kinds of research would be good for using citizen science as a tool. And a few things that I came up with, whenever large temporal and spatial scales are valuable, it's great to have the help that you can get from all of these free volunteers helping you. The research also has to be interesting and accessible, so kind of in a way it needs to be sexy. You're not going to get people helping with something that doesn't really light their fire. The protocols need to be simple, inexpensive, and it's really important that they can be adjustable, because you find early on that people sometimes can't do things that you thought they could do, so you need to kind of tweak the project. You also need to be able to judge the quality of the data that people enter. And it's also great if conservation and education can be included.